Sometimes I've thought that it's as if we have two bodies. The body that we have when we're not aware, and the body we have when we're aware. The two seems very different. To really be aware in this body, really aware, really present, attentive, comes along with the absence of other things, like the absence of distraction, the absence of desires and aversions and judgments and fears. Of course, they can come together to some degree, but when the mindfulness, the awareness becomes strong, when the knowing is clear, there's the kind of not much room, or that it's an alternative, it's an alternative space for our to experience our body, than the way we'd experience it if it's in the space of fear, the fear body, or the in the space of being filled with strong desires or strong aversions, anger, or we're just absent from it. And maybe all those funny things are going on in the mind, influencing, affecting the body, but we're out of touch. But when we're aware with this, I like to call it the simplicity of awareness, but the fullness of attention, it's kind of like we start having a different body. It's kind of like the body now has breathing room in which it can breathe, it can relax, it can open up, it can be known. And body that's known and has space, and the tensions begin releasing and relaxing, and different feelings and emotions tend to flow through us. What is healthy and wholesome tends to flow, and what is unwholesome tends to dissipate. It's kind of the direction, more or less, that things tend to go. So we have two bodies. The body that we have when we're not aware, and the one that when is aware, so different. Same thing with our minds. We have almost like two minds. The difference is so great between having our mind in automatic pilot, not really noticing what's happening in there, and spinning around. And then really seeing, really knowing. Seeing so clearly what's happening in the mind that it occurs to us that we don't have to believe everything the mind thinks. For some people, that's a radical idea. Some people identify themselves in their thinking. I think, therefore I am. And there's inconceivable that there's any alternative to being a self, but to think oneself into existence. And so sometimes it becomes really important to think, because you're constantly conceiving ideas and thoughts and stories that reinforce that we exist. And it can be frightening for some people to have some glimmer of possibility of a quiet mind. But to really see, really know this mind, and feel, actually, maybe I can't stop thinking, but, you know, I'm not really so invested anymore. You know, I've put a big investment in these thoughts, thinking mind, for some of us for decades. And maybe you've gotten a good return on the investment. It's possible occasionally. You've won the lottery. But, you know, I think the investment's often a poor return. So this no longer believing in some of our thoughts, no longer believing that that's where it's all the action is or what has to happen, that gets born from really seeing it clearly. And a remarkable thing happens to see it clearly enough, to know it clearly enough, where the knowing is not more discursive thought. Knowing is not more thinking. It might be a thought, and some of you know I like to distinguish between thoughting and thinking. It might be a thought, you know, in the knowing, simple, but it's very different than having a conversation, analyzing, story making. It's just, no, oh, this is thinking. Oh, this is leaning into thoughts. This is clinging to them. This is swinging from one thought, look to grabbing the next. This is ruminating. This is the mind jumping around between thoughts. To really see it and know it, it gives us a kind of different mind than if it's going on but we don't know it so clearly. It's almost like we have two different minds. And it's like we have two different hearts. Two different emotional centers, kind of. When we know it and when we don't. When we know, can really see, feel, understand what our emotions are, we can feel the ones that kind of have an ouch in them. Ouch. That doesn't feel so good. That's a little stressful, a little painful, it's contracted. That if we're not present, don't see, it is not seen. And so it's easy then to barrel ahead with painful, suffering-laden emotions because the object of the emotion is kind of like we're so focused on that, we don't notice the effect having the emotion has for us. So to really stop and feel and know, and feel the ouch, or feel the ah, this is nice. To feel what seems to be healthy, nourishing, and to feel what is not healthy and not nourishing. It makes a world of difference. So it's kind of like we have two different, you know, selves even almost, being, you know. It's so radically different, I think, between being present for our life and not really being present, not really being here. So we're practicing this, coming into this other option. We have a different options. Some people who kind of see what we're doing here might think that we're going into altered states of consciousness. I don't see it that way. I see that what we're going into here is returning to closer to something's more like the natural healthy state for the mind to be in. And the altered state is being stuck in congested traffic on Highway 17 and being in a hurry or being upset or fuming, or that's the altered state. If people like to call something an altered state. So just you know, when the attachments, when the preoccupations, the agitations settle enough so that these processes we have of the mind, the heart, the body just kind of begins to flow unobstructedly. They can feel nourishing, feel healthy. It's a healthy body. And from this perspective, some of the ways in which we live our daily life that might seem like ordinary and everyday can actually feel like, oh, now I see how stressful it is to be that way. That's not so useful. So here on retreat, we are living more, chances are we're living more of the day here in this Dharma-fed body than we are in the, some other kind of body that we're living out there. And there's things that are being fed and things that are growing. And one of the things that's growing is stability, steadiness, learning to be steady, hold it steady, be stable and rooted here, and then be able to hold the practice steady, to stay, hold the course. Don't get sidetracked, just hold the course. A great place to practice that is walking around the center. If you've made a decision to go someplace, like to the tea area, hold it steady. Just do that. Don't be tempted by the front door. Like, wonder what's out there. It's a sunny day. Let's go check that out before I have tea. Of course you can do that. That's innocent. But there's something about cultivating over, in all the different ways you can here, a steadiness, a purpose. I decided to have tea, and so that's the course I'm going to take. And then after, when I get the tea, then I can go look at the sun outside. Not because one is right or wrong, it's just that we want to kind of try to find a way to cultivate the steadiness here. Maybe you sit down at your meal, start eating it, and you think, oh, it'd be so nice to have a glass of water with the meal. Maybe, it's nice. And it's fine to get up and get it. But maybe steadiness is more found by just eat the meal when you're sitting there. And then, in a steady way, go get the water afterwards. Just kind of hold the course. Anyway, this developing of stability, steadiness, and an inner stillness, a sweet, soft stillness, begins growing. There can grow a sense of well-being, sense of appreciation, inspiration. This is great. This is good. This is healthy. This is, you know, this is a good way to live. This is good to have these way of being coming to the forefront. There can grow a sense of satisfaction, happiness, delight, joy. So it grows. So we're letting it grow. And so it's helpful to recognize it as it grows so that it, the more it's seen and recognized, the more it's available to support us. Maybe we can call upon it at a time of need. Call upon our steadiness or our stability when we're feeling unstable. Call upon our happiness when we're feeling challenged in it. And today, one of the things that's growing through this practice is confidence. Confidence in the practice, confidence in the Dharma, confidence in yourself as a practitioner. That there's a kind of strength in confidence that can grow. And it's a, I think the most powerful thing of this Dharma confidence is that we can develop more confidence in that than a lot of other things that are not so healthy. we have more confidence in the Dharma than we do have confidence in doubt. More confidence in the Dharma than we have confidence in aversion and anger, or greed, or despair, or fear, or more confidence in the Dharma than repeating stories from the past to yourself, or planning futures, or being in fantasies. And so this Dharma confidence that takes this manifests in, you continue to practice, just do the practice, show up, be here, hold steady, hold the course, not pushing, not straining, but, you know, take the next step, take the next breath, take the next moment of knowing, of mindfulness. Trust knowing, trust sensing, trust relaxing, trust showing up, trust being aware, trust going with that what's wholesome, nourishing, trust saying no thank you to what is not wholesome, not nourishing, not helpful. So this confidence in doing the practice, keep going, grows here. And one of the really inspiring places to kind of perceive this Dharma confidence that's growing is to, because maybe if as an individual you don't feel like you have much, like what's Gil talking about? But it's phenomenal the degree of collective confidence we have here as a group, as a community, as a Sangha. For this community to come together and practice in the way that we're doing here for these days, if you take random group of 44 people off the street to Santa Cruz, downtown Santa Cruz, and you know, they willingly say, yeah, you want to come and do a retreat? And they're a little bit crazy, so they say, yeah, sure. They trust you, and so you plop them down here. You get to be fed for a week and nice beds and your own room, and but you got to be silent. You got to sit and walk and sit and walk. It would not be as focused, as quiet, as centered as what we have here today at this retreat. It would be, I think the teachers would be really busy. And the managers. It's phenomenal what we have here. It's the expression of your confidence, or the collective confidence we have here. And I point to that because it's not always easy to have that confidence. So sometimes it's fine to borrow it, to be inspired or borrow the other people of confidence, people maybe you respect or inspired by. Okay, well, that person has confidence. If those people have it, okay, well then I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, or I'll follow through as if I have it or something. Or the getting a sense of the collective confidence that's here maybe gives a little more highlight to your own, so that you can value it, appreciate it. for a long time, my favorite word in that kind of confidence family, the Sada family, was trust. People used to ask me, "What do you trust, Gil?" Because you're supposed to have trust something, right? And I don't trust anything. I just trust. A number of my friends were quite perplexed by me. They thought you had to have something you trusted. But I just trusted. And I think that maybe there was something I trusted. I trusted the absence of wanting different, the absence of protesting what's happening, the absence of miscontent, the absence of being caught in clinging, the absence of clinging. I just trust. That kind of a trust where trust being available for this world. Trust be available for awareness, for receiving our experience. And as you know, sometimes this word sada is translated as faith in English. And sometimes in these decades of doing practice, I love the word faith. I love that there's a heartfelt quality to it. I think the word sada is related to the word pema. I mean, not related etymologically, but somehow in our hearts. Pema is kind of a word for kind of like love. So the heartfeltness. And when I think about faith, I think of faith is that we have faith when we have something we can put our whole heart into. We can put our heart into, what we put our heart into is the place where we have faith. So putting our heart into this practice, putting our heart into being of service. We have service leaders here that are supporting all of us. Putting your heart into your service jobs, the work meditation, sangha service we call it. To enter into these things with a kind of faith or wholeheartedness. And putting your heart wholeheartedly into the practice. This is a good place for your good heart to offer yourself. So these are all kind of in the family together, confidence, trust, faith. Another one that I put together in this family, this is all arbitrary. But I like the word sincerity. And how I understand the word sincerity is just do the best you can. You offer the best that's available, best you can, and that counts for a lot. I've said it many times, most of you know the story of Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master, being asked, if I do this practice, will I get enlightened? And Suzuki Roshi answered, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good. What a great answer, I thought. There's a kind of, humility and accepting that answer, as opposed to Yeah, but almost as good, it's second best. And I only want the best. If your practice is sincere, so there's one of the things growing is confidence, and that can grow kind of unnoticed. I think that was the case for me. I had no sense that confidence or faith had any role in practice really for a long time, and it wasn't kind of in my vocabulary or my concern, and I don't think my early teachers talked about it much. I had it, but it never occurred to me that I had it or it was important or something. I was young and naive, so I just kind of barrel ahead. But in retrospect, looking back, one of the ways of understanding what was happening to me was the confidence was growing. The faith, the trust, that sometimes takes the shape of refuge. That the refuge, going for refuge, is an active manifestation, expression of that faith, of that confidence, where the confidence says, this is how I want to live my life, this is how I want to be my life centered or oriented around. And so that's how it was for me, that I was discovering something through the practice, something that was felt quite valuable, quite wonderful, quite a bit better than the alternatives I knew how to live a life. And it became like, this is what I want to center my life on, is this is a way that feels like I'm being true and truthful and honest and present and compassionate. So this faith, this confidence grows. And it's a confidence that isn't passive. It's a confidence which is a kind of a fuel or an inspiration for keep practicing. Just keep showing up. Keep next step of practice, next breath, next act of knowing. It doesn't have to be, you know, doesn't have to be, you know, some big, glorious idea of where your practice is going. It can literally be the next step. If we're living in that next step, if we're living here. And so the final thing that I like to say about what to have confidence in, that we can grow over time to have confidence in, is we can have confidence in what I'm calling time, living in time. I have no idea what time is. But I do know that the past is just an idea of the mind, memories. Maybe someone might explain to me how the past really exists in some kind of way, but it can't be touched or smelled or seen or felt. Unless we're looking into the deep, dark sky and night, and then we're looking into the past. But that's not so interesting. What's interesting is here, living here. The past doesn't really have, it's kind of, what is it? It's nothing. And then the future. That means not only is it nothing, but any future you can imagine, except that you're going to die. Do you mean that it's... Who knows? Who knows? It's just thoughts, ideas, projections. So if there's kind of no past and no future, is there a present? Is there a now? And I'm sure there are people who disagree with me. But I'll say it for the purposes of doing this practice, I would say definitively, yes, there is. There is now. This is what's real. So to be in time, there's only this time. There's only this time now. This is the time to live. This is the time that anything really, or this is the only thing that really exists. Things will really exist in the future. Things really existed in the past. But, you know, that's not... But really what's true is this now. And so to have confidence in the value of living in time, in this moment, in this now, in this what's real in a certain way now, and have confidence that this is the doorway for the Dharma. This is where the Dharma is found. This is where the Dharma speaks to us, or this is where the Dharma teaches us. This is where the Dharma is expressed, manifested. Everything you need to know about the Dharma is available in time, in this time that's now. So that's another thing to have confidence in. Because some people, and I think probably all of us, to some degree, you'll find yourself one day, if the Martians, anthropologists of Mars comes and studies us, then you say, wow, there's a big percentage of these humans who have a lot of confidence in the value of thinking about the future. They spend an inordinate amount of time. They must really believe in it. Otherwise, why would they? Of course, they must have. Why would they do it unless they really thought that that is the important thing to do? There's an equally number of these humans who think about the past. They must have a lot of confidence that somehow that's important. Well, and then there must be the ones, the lucky ones, who spend an inordinate amount of time doing both. And then there's those few people who kind of seem to be in the present. But there's so few of them, we're not going to write them up for the big anthropological studies of humans. To have confidence in the value of being present here, more than confidence in your desires having to do with past or future. More than your... It's hard to say this. I mean, it's hard to... I know it's hard to do these things because so the forces inside of us are so strong. But to practically have more confidence and faith in the value of the practice, being here, being present, than we have confidence in fear. And surprisingly, some people have a lot of confidence in doubt. And they have to for the amount of time they spend in it. So to live in confidence, this Dharma confidence, to let it grow, it'll find you, it'll grow in you, just doing this practice. But it's also something to call upon. Call upon the faith, call upon the refuge, call upon your confidence in it all. To gently, lovingly inspire you to be sincere, to be wholehearted. And that, in turn, will be there to support you when you need it. And you'll need it one day. Like I said, I think yesterday, that this practice we do, sooner or later, is going to put us up against maybe the most difficult thing you'll ever do in your life. Maybe the most frightening thing you'll ever encounter in your life. It's kind of designed to do that, because those are the places where those are the places you need to see and will go through to be free, to let go of the clinging. But what a wonderful companionship to have when you come to that day. What a wonderful thing that your companions are stability and steadiness and happiness, confidence, faith, wholeheartedness, trust. I mean, to have those companions, you'll be fine. So for now, because that's the future, and here's Gil talking about the imaginary futures. Someday. But now, here, here is where these things exist. Here is where to discover the practice. Here is where to manifest or recognize whatever modicum of steadiness and happiness and confidence you can have. And so maybe when you do your practice, awareness practice, your knowing, your sensing, maybe you're relaxing, maybe you can feel how those qualities can be almost part of the knowing, almost part of the sensing, almost part of the relaxing and letting go. And if it's not, it probably will one day in that imaginary future. So then what do I notice sitting here after the talk? I noticed first that there was some, you know, I was a little bit energized giving the talk. But as I sat feeling that, it started to dissipate and quiet. And I could feel a fading away of the talk, or the fading away of my interest in the talk, fading away of my concern about the talk. Now I'm back into the talk a little bit, but there's a fading away, and I could feel that I'm in a new moment. The talk's kind of gone, and I'm kind of happy to go on to the next thing, or the next moment, or and then let it fade. I hope it was wise and useful, and the talk doesn't fade too quickly for you. I hope it's landed and it's useful. So, thank you.